Hi there, esteemed audience, and welcome to another episode of Middle Grade Ninja. I'm your host, Rob Kent. As you know, I'm the author of Banneker Bones and the Giant Robot Bees, the greatest novel ever written, about an 11-year-old detective who is a boy genius inventor of robots. He's flying around on a jetpack with his cousin, Ellicott Skullworth. They're taking on giant robot bees. You get past that first book, they're going to take on the alligator people, a whole cyborg conspiracy. It's a good time, and good news, you can get that first book, Banneker Bones and the Giant Robot Bees, as an audiobook, a paperback, or the ebook is free. Free to download whenever you're listening to this, wherever fine ebooks are sold. So check that out. Halloween has just passed, but if you're still in the mood for a scary story, and let's be honest, all the way up through Christmas and beyond, when is there ever a bad time for a scary story? Under the super secret pen name Robert Kent, I write some scary stories for older readers, such as All Together Now, a zombie story, and my young adult novel. And then a 5-volume serial horror series, The Book of David. If you're curious about that one, it's 5 volumes. It's about an atheist who purchases a haunted house that then begins to give him religious visions involving flying saucers. It is a good time, and you can get The Book of David, Chapter 1 by Robert Kent for free whenever you're listening to this, wherever fine ebooks are sold. So download that first chapter, or if you're curious, check the back catalog. Toward the start of quarantine, I recorded an amateur audiobook version of the first installment in The Book of David. So you can check that out as well. And then once you're hooked on the story, go buy yourself chapters 2, 3, 4, and 5. You'll have a good time. So it has been a week. I am recording this on November 7th, as of November 7th, 2020. I don't think we officially know who has won the presidential election, although it certainly appears to be Joe Biden. And I am smiling because I assume that it has been. But what an emotional week we've been through here in the United States. I don't have adequate words for it, and I'm not even going to try to summarize it. In fact, I'm going to be talking less and less politics going forward, because this is not a political show. I'm not a political pundit, and we don't need my view on every political thing happening in the world every Saturday. I think that focusing on books and reading is inherently political, because we're going to focus on an activity that engages critical thinking and empathy. And so for that reason, I feel that it's time to pull back from encouraging everybody to act politically and just go back to encouraging everyone to read. If you're reading, if you're critically thinking, the politics will hopefully sort themselves out. So today, I couldn't be more excited because I've got author Victoria Bond and a wonderful conversation to share with you. We are talking about her newest book, Zora and Me, The Summoner, which is the third book in the Zora and Me trilogy, which I have enjoyed from the start. We are going to be talking a little bit political because Zora and Me itself is focused on... what's the best way to say this? It's about Zora Neale Hurston, but it's also about Jim Crow America. It's about an America that the bright red state of Indiana made clear this week is not nearly far enough behind us. And we're also talking about Stephen King. We're talking about John Keats. We've got some actual ghost stories to go through. It's a good time. And episode 95 starts right now.
Victoria Bond, how are you this evening? And welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm fine. It's great to meet you, Robert. Thank you for having me on.
I am thrilled to have you on. I'm thrilled to talk about your new book, Zora and Me, The Summoner, the trilogy capper so far. We'll get into maybe there's a possibility for a book 4, but Zora and Me, The Summoner is available now. So Vicky Bond, I do not do other people's biographies, and I don't summarize other people's books because that's just a way for me to get myself in trouble on both. So the best place to start is if you would give the esteemed audience kind of an overview of your background.
Sure. Well, my name is Victoria Bond, and I'm in New Jersey. I grew up in New Jersey. I was raised by my grandparents, who both were voracious readers, And I wanted to be a poet from an early age, and this stuck with me for a while. I got an MFA in poetry. In that program, I met my husband. But before I went into that program, I got my first job in publishing, where I met T.R. Simon, who is the co-creator of the Zora and Me trilogy. And way back now, I guess in 2005 or 2006, TR, who is Tanya, told me that she had this idea. And I went over to her house for lasagna. And she said, "Look, Vicki, I want to write a middle grade series." And I said, "Really, you do?" And she said, "Yeah, about Zora Neale Hurston. You want to write it with me?" And I thought, well, maybe. Okay, great. Yes, of course. I want to work on it with you. And Tanya, I think we had worked together. We talked all the time about different types of ideas, stuff that maybe we could work on together, work on separately. You know, we were just really good friends that just chatted, chatted, and chatted. And I think you could ask her, but I'm pretty sure Tanya presented the Zora and Me idea, because I had just written, I had written my first novel that was absolutely and completely garbage, Robert. It was so bad. And I gave it to Tanya, and Tanya read it and said, "Yeah, Vicki, this is pretty bad. But there is a bright spot. You write young characters really well. You have like a group of like tweens in your book, and those are the parts of the novel that actually work." So I filed that away, and I think Tanya filed that away too. And between her idea and me just trying to learn how to write, kind of came together to co-create this series.
So lots to unpack there, and I definitely want to talk more about your process with Tanya and on why she wanted to work with you on this. But real quick, rewind, what was your job in publishing that you started with?
Oh my gosh, I was an administrative assistant at an agency. Tanya was an agent at the agency, and I just was hired straight out of college to go through the slush, answer the phones, schedule the lunches, that sort of thing. So that's how we met. And after that job, I went into the MFA program immediately. I quit one day, started the MFA program the next day, right? But it was a really good experience, you know, learning about how proposals are made, learning about the money side of publishing, what's in a contract, how it works. All that stuff was really invaluable learning.
So how long were you with the agency?
Oh my gosh, not very long. Maybe a year.
Learn about the money on publishing. You decide, I assume that there isn't any, and then pursue an MFA in poetry.
Right. Unless
you have the inside track on how to make the money with the MFA in poetry.
No, there's no inside track on how to make any money with the MFA, let alone one in poetry. I think I said there's no money in publishing, so why should I do anything for money, period? Let me just try to do something I like.
Fair enough. Did you, at that point, did you have plans to publish volumes of poetry? Do you still? What was their goal?
No, I never really had a plan to publish poetry. I think I more had a plan to write and to learn how to read and to kind of learn the history of literature. I think that was kind of more my plan. And to kind of co-create this series, it's been a really good kind of application of some of the skills that I've been honing, I think, as a teacher, as someone who loves literature, someone loves history, someone who really reveres literary figures and historical figures. This has been a way for me to kind of bring a lot of my loves together in that regard. It's been amazing working on Zora Neale Hurston. For those in your audience who don't know, Zora Neale Hurston was a novelist and an anthropologist in kind of mid-20th century America. She was born in 1891, and she lived a fascinating and strange and inspiring life for anyone who is pursuing the life of an artist or the life of the mind. And it's been really fun bringing her to life as a child, as a young person, for young readers.
So, okay, well, tell us a little bit of an overview of the series, and let's make sure we mention that The Summoner is available now, wherever fine books are sold. Tell us a little bit about the series, and then let's go back and let's talk about how this collaboration got started and how it works.
Sure. Well, Zora and Me is a middle grade mystery trilogy inspired by the childhood of Zora Neale Hurston, who was an anthropologist and a novelist. And in each of the Zora and Me novels, we use a mystery kind of horror genre trope to kind of dramatize the real life horrors of the Jim Crow South. So the first book is about racial duplicity, and we use a gator man, a gator monster, to kind of dramatize that for the children. The second book is a story about the sins of slavery in Eatonville, Florida, which in real life and in our books, of course, was one of the first all-Black incorporated towns. And in that novel, The Cursed Ground, Tanya uses a ghost to kind of explore the sins of slavery. And in The Summoner is about a lynching and a grave robbery, and then it kind of snowballs into this election. But for me as the author, I was focused kind of more on the graveyard zombie piece of it. You know, so for me describing the book to myself, I would say, you know, The Summoner is a zombie story. I'm trying to tell a zombie story, you know, out of left field. You know, I'm it's a zombie book. I'm trying to write a zombie book. I don't think I did, and you of course know better than I, but this was my college try at, you know, writing a kind of softball zombie story.
Well, I'll tell you, regular esteemed audience members who are wondering why would Rob can't be attracted to the Zora and Me series, I've got my Gator Man shirt on, and I've written about zombies. Maybe it's starting to come in the picture. Oh no, we're we're on the same plane creatively, I think. Well, did this satisfy your urge for a zombie novel, or is it possible we might still get a more traditional, straightforward Night of the Living Dead type of zombie novel from you?
I don't think so. I think I'm going to go back to the ghost mystery. I think I want to work. I am committed to the mystery genre. I'm committed to historical fiction, but I don't know necessarily if I want to stick with the zombie. I think I like the ghost, and I also like the monster as the suspect, you know, that kind of that story trope. Who is the killer? Was it a monster or was it a man? I like that too. So I think I am more, I think I got whatever zombie storytelling frisson I had. I think I got it out in this book. I don't know if it was a successful as I would have liked, but I think I've done it, and I think I'm going to try to move on.
Well, I think it was extremely successful, but that won't stop me from hoping that we get a little bit more before all is said and done. So, okay, so TR, Tanya and her lasagna corner you and say, hey, we're doing this. How does she present the idea? And then also, why is Zora... why Zora and Me, historical figures you could go for, why is she the one that you wanna incorporate?
So I think Tanya presented the idea to me because we were just very close friends. You know, the time I worked at the agency, we just spent like 5 days a week, you know, from 9 to 5, basically chatting. you know, in between our actual job. So we just became really close and we really got to know each other's minds. And that was kind of part of the fun of working on the series, was having kind of a built-in audience. Your collaborator is really the person that you're writing to. So at the very beginning of this, I can't believe it now, we started before Google Docs, right? And
what year are we talking that you're starting?
2005, maybe 2006. I can't believe it was so long ago. So we're starting before Google Docs, and Tanya tells me this idea, and you know, she has a background in anthropology, and you know, she's thinking, you know, she wants to put out there for kids of color, for all kids, for girls especially, this kind of spunky, take no prisoners, girl detective. And because she has this background in anthropology, and most of Zora Neale Hurston's books are anthropological works, so if you went to a library and you had all Zora Neale Hurston books on a shelf, there would be more anthropological books than novels. So, you know, she's really read now, I think, more closely in anthropology classes, you know, than she had been previously. So, you know, so Tanya had this, you know, girl detective, anthropologist, anthropologists study human behavior. They study people, you know, they want to know what makes people tick. Zora. For me, on the other hand, my relationship with Zora Neale Hurston was as like the supreme prose stylist, you know, especially as someone who has a background in poetry. I had never really thought very much at all about Zora as an anthropologist, as this kind of detective of, you know, human behavior. I just thought of her as kind of like this master poet, sentence by sentence. So I think in that regard, we were a good pairing because our relationship to Zora was so different. So I think each of us brought those two perspectives to our actual books. The writing process, again, way back then, before Google Docs, you know, that night when Tanya told me her idea over lasagna, we just kind of hashed out the plot.
And of one book or three?
Of one. But see, then the trouble got started when we had to try to figure out what the other two books were about. So we just kind of hashed out the plot. I went home. I got my Zora Neale Hurston reader off the shelf. You know, for about maybe like the next month, I read a couple of Zora's novels. I read her autobiography and I thought about it. And then I just started writing. So then I just wrote the manuscript. And I just gave it to Tanya, and Tanya was like, hey, Vicky, like, this kind of works. And then Tanya started rewriting it, added new characters, took stuff out, put in new scenes. And then we just went back and forth like that for a couple of months, just kind of trading a whole book. Now, of course, I think we would be in Google Docs together the whole time. You know, it wouldn't have been kind of this private relationship, you know, this private time that each of us had with the manuscript before we exchanged it. So I'm kind of grateful now for the way that that first book happened, because it was a really good experience for me just learning how to draft and then seeing the editing process go back and forth.
So are you, and obviously you and Tanya remain close friends, best friends forever. But was that a comfortable process that, hey, I've just had this wonderful experience, just me, just Zora and me, just having our wonderful time together. And now here comes Tanya, who wants to edit and add characters and change things. Is there any friction there, or is it mostly a wonderful experience and you're grateful that she's improving the work?
Oh, that was great. You know, it's a couple of weeks ago, my neighbor said, hey, wasn't it weird writing a book with someone? I'm like, no, if you find a smart person, write a book with them. That was great. Are you kidding? Yeah, no, it's like, it was made a billion times better. You know, it's like I learned more about the writing process from being able to observe, you know, all of the things that she added, took out. You know, I learned so much from watching her work on that first early draft.
And are there parts of that first book that when you reread them, you can say, well, that part's clearly me, pat on the back. Oh, this part's clearly Tanya. I should write her an email and thank her again for what a wonderful job she did. Or has it been, have you both gone back and forth over it so much that it's hard to tell where she begins and you end, or however the best way to phrase that is?
Yeah, I don't, you know, I'll be honest with you. I don't remember really writing anything in the book at this point. Like, I know that I did because I have, you know, it's kind of like I can remember thinking through stuff. Like, I know that I did it, but I think after a certain, so much time passes, you know, it's like I also have that experience with the summoner. Like, I can't even believe, like, I'm like, who wrote this? I guess I did. Okay, I guess I worked on it. I kept handing it in. You know, so I think for me, there's so much kind of distance between what the thing becomes and who the person was that sat down and wrote it. It doesn't really seem like me or mine anymore. Though I do have memories of very specific passages that are kind of tied up in my own, you know, kind of psycho-emotional world, but not very many.
Are there any particular passages that come to mind that you can comment on that have a very significant meaning to you?
In the first book, probably my favorite passage in the first book is about a daddy's girl versus a mama's girl. And I think I can remember it because I wrote that for Tanya as someone who was a mama's girl. Tanya was a mama's girl and not a daddy's girl. So when I wrote that passage about Zora, I was thinking of Tanya. So I remember that.
And then, okay, that's 2005 that the initial idea starts and you guys get going. At what point, because I'm trying to figure out why, we're just now getting to book three here in 2020, yeah, 15 years later, when one of you was a literary agent and one of you worked for a literary agent. You guys should have had some inside tracks, right?
Well, I think that's true. We had some inside tracks, but I don't know if anyone has inside tracks to writing a manuscript. You know, it's like you can have inside tracks of publishing, but really the hashing out of the manuscript, I think, is a completely different ball game. You know, so the first book was really seamless, you know, but it took a long time for it to get published. The second book, however, we went back and forth drafts for years that didn't work before we finally decided and were able to see, look, we don't even want to write the same book now. We have to split this off and you do book two and I do book three, because we're trying to mash books together that don't live in the same universe. You know, we're trying to make a Frankenstein body, you know, Frankenstein's monster. Hey, wait a second, these are two different books. So it took a lot of time to figure out that we weren't writing the same book for book two. And that's how we each were assigned, you know, you do book two and I'll do book three.
How'd you decide which would be which?
Because I wanted to, and I guess this is a spoiler, I wanted to kill Zora's mother. You know, like,
that's a huge spoiler.
Yeah, I was always like, I want to kill her. Like, I want her to die. You know, like, I want to try to write like that kind of sad thing. I want to write something that has a really definitive ending. You know, so I always had my mind on Zora's mother dying. So given that was the case, it made sense for me to close it out. You know, Tanya was really into Old Lady Bronson. So, and she wanted to explore Old Lady Bronson, and I wanted to kill Zora. So once we each had our thing, then it made sense, you know, who gets to do which book.
What a tremendous amount of trust, because of course, if the Cursed Ground isn't any good, we don't have to worry about readers keeping with the series to book three. And then, of course, if the Cursed Ground, as we know, was amazing, Well, now Tanya has to hope that you land this thing. Yeah. That's the big moment, right? It's book three. This is the trilogy capper.
Well, you know, it's funny, Rob. I think what we have found from book two to now book three is that I don't know how book two and book three are going to do, but I think it's book one that keeps selling. I think the summoner coming out just helps book one. I think Tanya's book just really helped book one. So I hope that Zora and Me, the first book, can kind of pull the rest of the trilogy up, so to speak. You know, so it's our joint effort that is kind of the engine of this train, you know, and I think Tanya's book, the sequel, is the best one. You know, I think my book has a lot more depth than the first one, you know, so it's a funny situation to be in when I think book two and book three are more mature than the first book, but I think the first book just keeps going, you know, it's just like a little engine that could, that first book just keeps selling, so we'll just see how it goes.
So when you're working on book two and book three and Tanya's doing her thing, you're doing your thing, is it really as clear cut as that, or are you still going over each other's drafts and refining some version of the initial voice that you started off with that was a combination of your...
Yeah, no, it was a clean break in that regard. You know, I read Tanya's book, you know, maybe a draft and a half, like 1.5 draft. So it was pretty much like all there, you know, so I was just like, wow, this is a great book, you know, and I think, you know, I gave the draft of The Summoner, because I'm slower and messier, I think I couldn't give it to anyone to read until maybe like draft 3.5, you know, and unlike Tanya, who writes really fast, I write really slowly. So, you know, so our pace was just completely different. And yeah, I think it worked out okay. I wonder how similar the voices are. You read all three books, Rob. What do you think? Are the voices similar? Does it go astray? I hope that it coheres.
I think that they're very, very similar throughout. I could tell a clear difference in some of the prose with The Summoner versus The Cursed Ground. Mm-hmm. But that's because I just went back and reread part of The Cursed Ground because mm-hmm. it had been a couple of years. Like, oh yeah, what happened last book? Okay, right. I'm reading a book at least every week for just to keep up with guests on the podcast.
Plus, yeah.
My own for fun reading.
You're a hero.
Yes, that is what I was getting at. I'm glad you said it so I didn't have to. No, but what I did wonder is if there was something at this point, now that it's your book and mm-hmm. Tanya got her own, she had her say. If there was mm-hmm. something in this book that she didn't care for, did she still get to weigh in and say, hey, we should change this so it's a little bit more true to our partnership, but it just never came up.
Never came up. Yeah, no, that never came up.
Gotcha. So do you think that you and Tanya will write a fourth book or maybe a new series together? Or are you going to be branching off and working on your own for a while? What's the plan?
Oh, you know, that's a good question. I think that we will always work together in some capacity. You know, I don't know if we'll ever work together like this again, but I think we will continue to work together kind of behind the scenes. So that's been what's developed since Zora and Me, is that we've continued to kind of work together in publishing, but in different capacities.
Well, I mean, presumably, if for no other reason, just to continue to promote the series.
Oh, yes. I know. All right. And that's for me. Like, I'm not even thinking of that. I'm like, oh, yeah, of course. But yeah, I just think of all this other random work stuff that comes up for us all.
Well, I mean, it's possible that like Stephen King and Peter Straub started hating each other back in the 80s. But by God, they've got another book in that series coming up. The Bleak House, I can't remember. Somebody's shouting at me. Lamar Giles is shouting at me because mm-hmm. he's a huge Stephen King fan.
Well,
I can't remember the name of the first book.
Well, you know, I am also a huge Stephen King fan, and I guess it was
The Talisman. Oh my God!
Whew. Yeah. So
I was gonna lie awake all night trying to think of what the title of that. I was gonna Google it, but it was gonna bother me that I couldn't remember.
There are so many, and it gets hard to tell when you read which one and what happened, and yeah. So, but I'm with you there. I've been a big fan for a while, and you know, The Summoner, I couldn't have written this book if I hadn't read Pet Sematary, actually. You know, Pet Sematary kind of got me through a rough patch, you know, and working on the manuscript. So
when did you read Pet Sematary originally then?
Gosh, while I was writing this book.
For the first time?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I think, you know, because it really got me, because my son was 2 years old, and we lived in a busy neighborhood full of deliveries and trucks, and my son was just learning how to walk and crossing the street. And, you know, so it really, it got me in that parent place of danger and vigilance. Yeah. So, but I read the book because I was interested in the story of resurrection, you know, and kind of the psychology of resurrection. And so that's why I was like, yeah, maybe I should read Pet Sematary, you know, and I did. And it really was an enormous help.
I read that one on I'm going to date myself, on a Habitat for Humanity missions trip with my church group when I was all of, I think, 13 or 14. And it was the most rebellious thing I could have done, because they were all reading their Bibles and I had my Stephen King, and the parents were looking at each other and looking at me. And I couldn't very well whip out a pack of cigarettes, not at that age. But that book about the same amount of reaction from the adults as if I had whipped out cigarettes.
Oh,
so
wow.
I loved it mostly for that. I read it again as an adult. Yes, as a parent. Mm-hmm. Random anecdote. What other, other than Pet Sematary, what other inspirational text did you draw from for the series and for The Summoner?
So for the whole series, you know, Zora Neale Hurston's autobiography, Dust Tracks on the Road, I think is kind of a key work. And for us, it's really like the first like 15 pages. That's all she really gives to her childhood, which is amazing for fiction writers, because you have a little bit that you can really just like explode. So, you know, so it's not so much that it overwhelms your imagination, but it's just enough that kind of is able to kind of turn the knob to kind of explore a lot of different stuff in these books. The key Zora book for The Summoner was actually Zora's first novel, Jonas Gårdvin, which is really about her parents and about her father, who in real life and in at the end of that novel dies in a car accident. So that was something I kept in mind when I was working on The Summoner, thinking about the horseless, the cars, you know, like this new invention that everyone wants and some people have. So I always kept that in mind, that John Hurston will die in a car accident. So that book.
You are very focused on, yeah, on the death of your parents.
Yes, I have been. The other thing, actually, that really stayed with me, well, I guess two things related to the zombie piece of this. So the real Zora Neale Hurston photographed this woman in 1936 in Haiti, who was believed to be a zombie. She had been buried in 1917 by her family, and this woman reappears in 1936, and she hardly speaks. She's physically very changed, but her family confirms that it is her. And this woman had been hospitalized. Her name was Felicia, and someone calls up Zora Neale Hurston and says, look, there's a real zombie, you know, at this hospital. You should go see her. And Zora does go, and she takes this photograph of this kind of really, this woman that's clearly been broken by whatever experiences she's had between the time she died and the time she resurfaced. So that was something that also really stayed with me. And Zora documented that and kind of talks about her experiences with voodoo in a book called Tell My Horse. So that was one key that I was kind of weaving in and thinking through in the seminar. Another thing, kind of totally unrelated, I'm a big fan of poetry. I love romantic poetry. My son is named Keats, for John Keats. And there is a fragment of John Keats's about a hand, you know, and this hand is warm with life. And if it were to die, it can, you know, come at you. Would you, you know, would you reanimate this hand with life? That's kind of the gist of the fragment. And that was like a weird kind of like zombie moment in romantic poetry. And I just kept thinking of John Keats's hand. And that got into the book with Carrie, who is the narrator of all three novels, having this hand injury, you know, from doing laundry and whatnot. So I was when Carrie's hand is hurt, the author is thinking of John Keats's hand from this fragment of poetry. So those are, I think, the big influences that were at work in the book.
How about when you're writing a fictionalized version? I mean, Zora is very, I heard you and Tanya compare her to Sherlock Holmes, to Carrie's Watson.
Yeah.
When you're, and obviously the real life Zora was extremely Sherlock Holmes as a child, but how much leeway do you feel you have when you're writing about somebody who's kind of sort of real, even though she's not exactly the version you're writing about?
Mm-hmm. Well, I never felt like I didn't have leeway. It never occurred to me not to do what I wanted to do. I think in part because I never considered writing anything about young Zora that would be out of step with who she became. You know, I guess I always kind of gave myself the credit of honoring her memory and honoring her legacy and her work. So I never put any bounds or barriers around what I could or couldn't write or say or not say. Because I guess I just always knew within myself and within the universe of these books that whatever we would say would be in step and honor some aspect of who she was in life and what her work is a testament to.
And when you're writing about 1905, how much research are you doing? Are you actually going out and doing a little bit of laundry the way that they would have done it then? To get that experience, or are you just reading about it and that's more than sufficient to give you what you need to write? Mm-hmm. How do you do your research and how much of it was necessary?
Well, I mostly did reading. You know, I didn't learn how to do the laundry, but I will tell you that the whole kind of laundry piece of it came from a book by a friend of mine called No Mercy Here, which is the story of Black women and incarceration in the Jim Crow South. And one thing that I discovered when I read that book is that Black women laundresses were often blamed for illnesses. So if someone became ill in a household, the laundress was accused of doing a poor job and, you know, proliferating the illness or the virus from, you know, a lack of cleanliness. So that was, I know, right? It's like insane. Like someone, you get sick and you like say the laundress did it. It's like, what? But like, this was a thing. So that's something else that kind of got woven into the fabric of the book, laundry and the connection to illness. You know, I was kind of turning that over. Another thing in this book that also got into the summer. So maybe I should really, you know, credit Sarah Haley's book, No Mercy Here, as like another big influence, because clearly it was. Another thing that got into the book was The Fugitive and, you know, the lynching. You know, so that was kind of another thing that I learned about from this book, No Mercy Here, is that when a fugitive was on the run, whoever the black people were in that area, wherever the fugitive happened to be, you know, moving through, or wherever he or she was suspected to be, the black people in that area became suspects and were often raided and harassed and so forth. You know, irrespective of whether or not they knew the person, had heard of the person, you know, it's just all happenstance, you know, based on you're here, you're black, you're involved. Like, huh, what? What are you talking about? I don't know. So that also was a thing that got worked into the summoner as well.
I love that Zora's mother is immediately defiant, doesn't believe the official story about why this person is on the run, and is just openly saying that, hey, if they come around, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to harbor him because it's mm-hmm. my Christian duty.
Mm-hmm.
But, hey, maybe you don't say that so loud, but yeah, right on.
I felt like I couldn't not write that in, you know, because I just, it didn't feel like everyone would deny someone in need, you know. I felt like it would be against the nature of the people that we have been writing these books about for everyone to turn off their lights, shut the door, and say, no one's here, you know, good luck. You know, I couldn't stomach that for these characters. And I hope if put in a similar situation, I would do the right thing, not the safe thing. So.
Well, fortunately, racism is a thing of the past, and I'm sure we'll never have to deal with any similar circumstances.
Yeah, oh, that's over.
Well, let's dive into that just a bit, because you are writing about the Jim Crow South. Mm-hmm. This is a middle grade novel, but you're not sugarcoating anything.
Mm-hmm.
You're making reference to violence, to rape, among other horrific things throughout the book.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, this is book three, so the nice thing you've got going for you is any adults that might be up in arms, I think children will be fine, but any adults that might be up in arms, that this is too advanced for a middle grade audience. Well, they had two books to get the tone and the gist of this series. This shouldn't be a surprise by the summoner.
Mm-hmm.
But how did you and Tanya approach that to tell the truth, but to keep things appropriate for a middle grade audience?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question. You know, so I think it never occurred to us not to present the history and the reality of the dynamics at play here. I think that, in fact, was the reason why we wanted to write these books at all, is that it gave us a chance to explore these issues with a young audience. So I think that that was, you know, writing about Zora Neale Hurston gave us, again, kind of a gateway into discussing so many different types of issues related to race and gender in the context of Eatonville, which was extremely unique as one of the first all-Black incorporated towns. So in that regard, I felt like we got to have it kind of both ways. We get to explore the racism and the sexism of the Jim Crow South, but we get to do so in this very unique context of a kind of contained Black democracy, which was something that I really loved exploring in the Summoner. About what I, you know, what I say or what I think about presenting these issues to a, you know, a young audience, a middle grade audience, it's like kids are watching this news that we're all watching, right? Kids are at these protests. Kids have relatives that are, you know, abusing them, abusing other people, abused by the police. You know, kids are in middle, especially middle schoolers, middle graders. They're in the middle of all this stuff. So my position has always been like, how dare anyone gaslight kids? You know, kids are in tough situations. They're seeing this stuff. They're doing tough things themselves. Kids need some help. they need to have virtual experiences, right? Navigating difficult situations so they can kind of grow their skill set, grow their coping mechanisms, you know, have some insight into how other people have navigated things that no one should have to navigate, right? So I feel like kids are living life and it's hard. How dare anyone pretend that it's not?
Well, you know, I 100% am with you, and yet I was horrified just this very day. One, I just learned that there was a thing called Prager University a week ago. I was happier not knowing that it existed, mm-hmm. Which for those of you that aren't aware, don't look it up. It's just terrible, but it's a very much propaganda, pro-right-wing propaganda. And I just learned that there are schools in Ohio and elsewhere that are incorporating that as part of their curriculum. So I'm hoping it's those students that most need to read Zora and Me and need to know that, no, you're being lied to. Read the actual history, understand what happened.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a question in there, just my own horror at having learned these things recently.
Yeah, well, you know, something that I often think is that as much as, you know, kids of color, readers of color need representation of people like them, need to see people like them, need to read depictions of their own history, I think white kids and white readers need books that focus on kids of color and their experiences and their humanity just as much, you know, and it just blows my mind that these issues aren't at the forefront of, you know, curriculum, basically, and, you know, in history and English classes across the board, just because they help grow all of our humanity, you know, period. You know, as a kid, surprise, I'm Black, right? But like as a kid, it never occurred to me, this white character is being so white, I can't understand them, they're so different than me. You know, I think kids of color read and we're just absorbed in the experiences of the characters, what their lives are, what the story is, in a way that I can't believe I'm saying this, but for me as a kid, so most of my reading experiences were colorblind, even though most of the books I read were by white people and about white people. It never was a barrier to me expanding and, you know, expanding my sense of humanity reading about white people. So I think, you know, Black kids of color have been doing this for a millennia. I think some white kids can do it too. You know, like it's not a big deal. It's just, you know, it's just a book with Black people in it. Like we've been reading like lots of books with white people in it. It's not a big deal. Like it's just a book. It has the story. Just, you know, it'll be fine.
Well, it is a big deal because more white children do need to read these things. It's a shame that for so long, many of them haven't. Because it's not Black history, white history. This is American history. This is all of our history. If you're wondering how things got to the point we're at now, well, it didn't start the moment you were born. A lot of this stuff has been in motion since long back. Not that I need to tell you.
Yeah. But thank you. But no, but thank you, because I was being a little bit glib. So thank you for giving the topic the gravity that it deserves.
Well, I just read the book. You're the one with the gravity. My book has alligator people and jetpacks. I'm not touching Jim Crow South thus far in my literature. Maybe we'll get there. Have you thought about what might be next for you? Are you going to stick with historical fiction, or have you got aspirations for something completely new?
Oh, no. Historical fiction, I really love it. I think in part because I don't feel like I want to navigate or write a story that has, as my grandmother would say, a lot of newfangled aspects in it. You know, I kind of like stories that occur in the time, I think, of the first stories that I ever heard. So I was raised by my grandparents. They both were, you know, big readers. My grandfather was an excellent storyteller, and he would often tell me stories about things that happened to his parents and his grandparents and in his own life. So I think from a very early age, without really knowing it, now, of course, I'm telling you, I recognize it. You know, I was kind of injected with this storytelling bug, but the storytelling bug is very tied to history. You know, so that's where I feel comfortable. I think it's because those are the first stories I heard and I loved and felt connected to because they were about family members. So I think that's kind of where my storytelling brain lives mainly, is in the past.
Any particular time that you hear the siren song calling you toward?
Oh, now 1890s. Yeah, the 1890s. You know, I have spent a lot of time writing about Florida, and I'm from New Jersey, and I want to write about New Jersey. New Jersey has a lot of weird history, so I've been, you know, kind of getting my feet wet, kind of navigating and thinking about where I'm from. So, yeah, we'll see.
Ah, fair enough. Unfortunately, I did the same thing with Indiana. Oh, so much unpleasant history.
Yeah.
The Great Hoosier State was the former head of the Ku Klux Klan right here, friends.
Yeah. Oh, Lord. Yes. Yes. But yeah, it's like the history stays with us. It's never really over. It's not this over.
Is a part for regular esteemed audiences who don't know. I had an experience because I grew up in a small, very segregated town that never seemed segregated. Our claim to being anti-racist was we all liked the nice Cosby family on television. So what could be the problem?
Mm-hmm.
And then I married met a black woman in college, and we got married, and it was, oh, look at all this history that's been denied me. Mm-hmm. Look at all these things that we didn't talk about and I didn't know, which is why I'm so glad that you're out there reaching not just children of color, but the poor white kids in small Indiana towns like I was that don't know this stuff. Give it to them. They need it.
Yeah.
So, okay. Vicky Bond, have you ever seen a flying saucer and or a ghost?
I think I have seen a ghost.
You tell.
I think I have seen a ghost. I think I've seen a ghost twice, actually. I think I've seen two ghosts. Oh, Lord. You do pull this stuff out of people.
I ask everybody. I promise I'm not signaling you out. I live a good ghost story.
Okay. Well, I don't know if this is a good one. But, oh, boy, the year is probably 1989. And do you remember Woolworth, like the old, super old drugstore? Even when I was a kid, there were still like stools in the back with like a soda fountain. So that stuff was still intact, even though it wasn't in use anymore. So on a Sunday, like it was starting to get dark. It was like early, probably like early December. I went to Woolworth's like to buy like wrapping paper or something with my mother. And when we left the store to get in the car that was parked in front of the store, under a streetlight, there was a woman with like really giant hair. And she was kind of like writhing back and forth to like maybe, I don't know if it was like headphones, but she was just kind of writhing back and forth. And I looked at her and it was just so strange. Then, so I was kind of scared of this woman, but not so scared that like I clung to my mother or even said anything about it. And then that night we went home and, you know, I went to bed, and then I got up and the, like, I don't know. And it was like the lights were still on, you know, it wasn't like a, you know, everyone wasn't asleep yet. Right. And I got out of bed, and in the hallway, the woman was standing there.
She followed you home from Woolworths.
No, well, but it felt real. So I got back in the bed. I turned around, got back in the bed. And I think I've only ever told this to my husband. Was it a ghost? Was it a trick of the mind? Probably a trick of the mind, but it felt so real, you know? And I think the other thing that made me think that maybe why the story comes to mind is that it never felt like my mother saw the woman. You know, when we left Woolworths and got in the car, it was almost like I only saw her, that my mother, you know, because my mother is kind of a mean-spirited, you know, kind of chatty, gossipy observer, you know, so she always has trash to talk about people and say this and that. Rah, rah, rah. So, but my mother didn't say anything. So, you know, so that's one. The other one, I was on the subway. This was probably maybe like 2004, 2005. And you never know if like people are just rude and crazy or what. But there was this old man who was standing up in front of the doors. And I noticed him, and something about him made me feel a little sad. You know, I think when you see an elderly person standing up and, you know, you just are like, why are you standing up? There are seats and, you know, and I felt sad just looking at him. And then someone got on the train and kind of like bumped this man. And I said to the person, you just bumped him. And then the guy looked at me like I was crazy. And then when I looked back at this man, this old man who I thought who was standing, he was gone.
And he didn't follow you home, probably, presumably, because he appreciated you speaking up for him.
No, but the way that the man looked at me, he didn't, you know, he was just like, are you like, what are you talking? Like, you know what I mean? Like, you're just seeing stuff. You're crazy. Like, I didn't, you know, so then I was like, you know, because it was his response to me calling him out wasn't, you know, like, it wasn't like, don't tell me what to do. You know, you can't, you know, it wasn't aggressive. It was really like, what are you talking about? And then when I looked and the man was gone, it's like, so yeah, so that's it.
Does that lead you to question reality in other situations? Are there maybe people out there and you've been seeing that the rest of us aren't seeing, you think?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so.
Maybe about 4 or 5 o'clock tonight when you're lying awake.
No, I hope not. Oh, gosh. No.
What a terrible thing to say to a guest. It's been so wonderful. Here's something to bother you later. I apologize. I withdraw it. So here's a flattering question. Let me pivot back to writing.
Okay.
I love to ask anybody that's won an award. I myself, and I imagine esteemed audience listening, would love to win. I like to ask what that experience is so we can all live vicariously through you for a moment. So what was that experience of winning the John Steptoe Coretta Scott King Award for New Talent?
That's really nice of you to ask. I think that I'm not the best person to ask a question like that, because living vicariously through me is, you know, just having one shoe drop and then another shoe drops and then you just are like, ah. So I remember the day that we got the news that we won that award. I really didn't experience it as a win, because my husband was trying to switch jobs and there was some kind of intrigue between bosses. And, you know, it was kind of like, is he going to get fired and not get the new job and that sort of thing. So when we received the news, I was just kind of caught up in my husband's kind of professional intrigue and just was terribly worried that he was going to be unemployed.
So unless this award comes with a year's worth of salary, I'm not that concerned right at this
point. Yeah, which I think, you know, for us, you know, regular people that write because we love it and have other stuff that often is more important for better or for worse, you know, it was a nice thing. But still, when I think about it, I think about just how funny life is in that regard. You know, like this one big thing happens, but what is present on your mind and on your heart is like the kind of the daily grind. You know, so for me, it's always kind of like the daily grind, the daily mishaps, you know, the intrigue here and there around work and money that I feel probably for most of us ends up taking precedent over these things when they happen.
Well, that's the nice thing about starting a podcast, which I absolutely recommend everybody do. Because then it's recorded, and sometimes these conversations that I get to have with incredible people such as yourself don't really hit me until about time number 3 or 4 when I'm editing them, and I've heard them, and I've internalized everything. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, I'm so glad that I got all of that recorded, because I would have spent the rest of my time worrying about the thing that happened immediately after the podcast when, you know, the phone rang with some bad news.
Exactly.
And now that I've got it recorded, I can go back and I can relive it. Yes, that was a part of my life. That really happened. Oh, how wonderful.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly it. You know, so I think that I don't think we hear that from people enough. You know, like, oh, this cool thing happened to me. But while it was happening, I was just like really worried about, you know, paying my bills. So I think if we heard that from people more, I think we would feel more compassion for each other and maybe more love. You know, we wouldn't take each other so seriously, which maybe would allow us to take ourselves a little bit more seriously.
Yeah, that would be nice. I'm on board. I like this plan of yours. If your esteemed audience is ever curious, most every podcast, what's going through my mind is don't say something dumb. Don't say something dumb. Don't say something dumb. Yeah. We're talking about Jim Crow slavery. Why are you doing most of the talking? Stop talking. But then afterward, when I go back and I can listen to it, like, oh, look, listen to all the brilliant things my guest said, and I don't have to panic that I'm about to bring the whole thing down. Like, I know it ends well. Now I can really enjoy it.
Yeah, you're great. This has been great. Thank you. You're amazing.
I'm looking at our time and I realize I don't have time for a couple of questions. So let me ask you this. If there was something that you could go back and say to a younger version of yourself toward the start of your career, that would have hopefully made a significant difference and made easier for you the path toward being a writer, what would you go back and say to yourself that maybe would hopefully also make easier the paths of those listening?
Mm-hmm. Stop editing as you write. Just get to the end of the draft. Stop editing. Just write to the end and edit from the beginning through the end. Stop creating all of the ripples in the story that become impossible to tame. Just write the draft.
Were you a big non-finisher of drafts? Did you have a bunch of partials sitting around that you were reworking and not finishing for a while?
I think that The Summoner took me a really long time, because I edited so much as I was writing, and a lot of the edits I made were not so great and awesome, and they caused different ripples in the manuscript that made me have to keep kind of going here and there and everywhere to keep editing, you know. So I think now I am just committed to just get through the draft, see what it's like, and then go back and make changes and create those ripples. But I think for me, at least, my advice, don't create the problems until you have a draft, and the draft will be its own thing, right? in my experience, editing as I went along made more problems than it solved.
Fair enough. Victoria Bond, this has been an absolute pleasure. Where can the esteemed audience find you online? Where can where can they find out more about you, follow you on Twitter, all that good stuff?
Yeah. So I am at Way to Go Vicky Bond, V-I-C-K-Y, Bond, B-O-N-D, at Instagram. And my website is victoriabondauthor.com.
I'm just reminded I forgot to ask you about your blog and your writing for The Guardian and The Huffington Post. Well, we'll save something for next time. When your next book comes out, you'll come back and we'll talk all about it.
Yeah, well, I was an occasional essayist. If I could ever get it together again, I would try to write an essay or two. But I don't, novels, at least for me, kind of suck all my writing energy, and it doesn't leave a lot of time to, you know, contemplate oneself as much as you're just kind of struggling with your characters and trying to get point A to line up with point B.
Do you know when we can look forward to your next novel?
No, I don't. I don't know. No, I don't know. I don't know. Not as long as it's taken for the Zora trilogy to be completed. Not nearly as long. No, I would say a year or two, not 5-10 years. I think the 5-10 years of writing and hemming and hawing and crying, I think those days have thankfully wrapped up. So.
And that is the perfect note to end on. Esteemed audience, as always, head to middlegradeninja.com, read my interview with T.R. Simon, get the back catalog of the show, read interviews with other authors, publishing professionals, folks you'd be interested in, download your free copy of Banneker Bones and the Giant Robot Bees, and as always, God willing that I'm alive, I'll see you next week.